It is Wednesday, December 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry outlines his vision for an Israeli-Palestinian accord.
And we cannot properly defend and protect Israel if we allow a viable two-state solution to be destroyed before our own eyes.
China announces its goals regarding its space program, and pop singer George Michael dies. We remember his career. It's all ahead. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry on Wednesday launched a last-minute bid to preserve the broad outlines of a two-state solution between Israel and the Palestinians. The speech followed the U.S. decision to abstain from a United Nations Security Council resolution that condemned Israeli settlements.
And we cannot properly defend and protect Israel if we allow a viable two-state solution to be destroyed before our own eyes. And that's the bottom line. The vote in the United Nations was about preserving the two-state solution. That's what we were standing up for. Israel's future is a Jewish and democratic state, living side by side in peace and security with its neighbors.
Kerry said the Obama administration has worked closely with the Israeli government.
No American administration has done more for Israel's security than Barack Obama's. The Israeli Prime Minister himself has noted our, quote, unprecedented military intelligence cooperation.
I spoke with VOA's William Gallo about Kerry's State Department speech and asked him why Kerry is making it now at the end of his tenure as Secretary of State.
Sure, yeah, there's only a month left. It is kind of confusing to a lot of people, but one thought is that he's trying to preserve his own and Barack Obama's legacy, setting the parameters for a future peace deal, a two-state solution. But another idea is that Kerry is actually concerned that the two-state solution won't actually be viable for very much longer, and so he's using very harsh language to sort of warn of that reality.
Yeah, I mean, looking forward, could this, you know, some of the opinions that Kerry is using at this point, I mean, could this further, you know, could this strain relations with Israel, getting into the next administration?
Right, and you know, a lot of people have warned of that, saying that Donald Trump now will be more likely to even take a more hawkish view on Israel, to stick up for Israel even more than he already seemed like he was going to. And so that could, yes, in a way, possibly make a two-state solution even more unlikely. At least that's what a lot of analysts are saying.
What has President-elect Donald Trump said about this issue?
Well, he has been a little bit mixed on that. About a year ago, he said that he wanted to push really hard for a two-state solution, saying he would be even-handed. That created a lot of controversy. Since then, he has moved further towards Israel's corner, promising to be a unwavering ally, being very critical of Obama's recent diplomatic moves. So, I mean, it's really unclear. Anything that Donald Trump does, it seems unclear at this point, but it seems he's going to be much more pro-Israel than what Obama has been.
That's VOA's William Gallo. Joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, this John Kerry speech is trending not just in the U.S. but worldwide as people kind of parse through what he's saying, examining the feasibility of a two-state solution, which is something that he mentioned in that speech. A lot of sentiment that this speech and the sentiments behind it are anti-Israel. We're seeing that repeated again and again. And that fits with what William was just talking about, perhaps with the Trump administration having a different position on Israel. You're seeing a lot of Trump supporters and a lot of conservatives taking aim at this speech on social media, saying that it's taking a different path than they would like to see as far as Israel. So as that speech continues, we'll continue to monitor that and the social media reaction therein. Here in the U.S., another big trending story that we talked about earlier in the year was in Congress during a gun control debate. They had turned off the cameras that broadcast from the House of Representatives, and so the congressmen there were actually live streaming using Facebook Live and Periscope on their phones from the House floor. Well, months after that, House Speaker Paul Ryan has introduced rules that would give the House Sergeant-at-Arms power to fine members up to $2,500 and otherwise punish them for live streaming on the floor of the House. Now, this has kicked off an interesting legal debate because apparently in Article 1 of the Constitution buried in there are rules governing the doling out of punishments for the House of Representatives, and it says it must be done by the elected members. Sergeant-at-Arms is not an elected member of the House of Representatives. So we'll see if this actually comes to fruition, if they can actually ban people from using their phones and live streaming on the floor of the House. But I think now that the cat's out of the bag, it's going to be really hard to get it back in. I think that this is the new technology that's so pervasive in our lives, in everyone's life, including congressmen, that we might actually see more of it going forward to try to connect more people, constituents, to their representatives.
Yeah, and all those rules were written a long time before Facebook and Twitter.
Only about 240 years or so, yeah.
All right, thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. Prominent Republican U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham predicts sanctions on Russia over interference in the U.S. election. The Charleston shooter will not submit evidence during the penalty phase of his trial. German police detain a Tunisian man allegedly linked to the Berlin truck attack, and Nabil Rajib had been jailed for 7 months. He's an activist in Bahrain. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study published in the medical journal Molecular Psychiatry suggests that overindulging on a lot of high-fat foods as a youngster could harm a person's cognitive functions as an adult. It's no secret that children and teens love to eat junk food. Eating high-fat foods over a long period of time can lead not only to problems such as obesity and possibly damage young and still developing brains, but new research is showing that eating a lot of fatty foods during adolescence may impact the brain in adulthood. The findings were made after researchers compared the brains of young and adult mice who were fed either high-fat or normal diets. The first signs of impaired cognitive functions of young mice who ate a high-fat diet started to show after 4 weeks and before they even started to show a weight gain. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we remember the late actress and writer Carrie Fisher. China this week issued a white paper on its space program outlining a series of ambitious goals over the next 5 years. Although its space program began in 1956, it did not achieve manned spaceflight until 2003. It has since conducted a spacewalk, sent a rover to the moon, and last month completed its longest manned space mission, a month, by two astronauts aboard an orbiting experimental space station. Its white paper is entitled China's Space Activities in 2016. In it, China outlined new manned space flights, lunar exploration, and possibly its first MARS probe by 2020. Morris Jones is an independent author and analyst on the Chinese space program, and he's based in Australia. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty that after reading the white paper, he believes China is serious about taking what is already a world-class space program further into space and capability to become the world's dominant space power.
They're moving ahead very rapidly. They have a very impressive human spaceflight capability. They've recently completed their longest space mission to date, which is roughly a month, and they're preparing probes to go to the moon and deeper into space. So it's already one of the world's best space programs, probably, I would say, the equivalent of the European.
Its white paper, titled China's Space Activities in 2016, actually looks forward some 5 years. It says China always adheres to the principle of exploration and utilization of outer space for peaceful purposes. Is that accurate?
It's not accurate at all, because China has one of the world's most advanced military space programs. They use space flight for most aspects of their military, communications, surveillance, weather forecasting. But one of the rising trends in China is the fact that they have a very aggressive development program for anti-satellite weapons. They've been able to hit satellites in low orbits for quite some time, but they're also getting the capability to hit satellites in geostationary orbit or orbits that are slightly lower than geostationary orbit, which means that they can probably try to knock out America's GPS satellites in the event of war.
Well, one of the things that stood out to me in this China white paper was China's proposed soft landing of a probe on the far side of the moon, which has never been done before, and that could happen in just a year or two.
China has been planning this for a very long time, but they've never made any secret of this as a long-term plan. So the latest white paper just reiterates the fact that those plans are still on track. It's a very ambitious technical challenge to land on the far side of the moon because there is no direct line of sight to the Earth. Communications. So they've got to use some very advanced technology, including a special communication satellite in a very unusual orbit so that ground controllers can talk to it. But what I also think is interesting to consider is the fact that the white paper gives further hints that even beyond landing robot probes on the moon, China is moving steadily in the direction of eventually sending humans there.
And that is analyst Morris Jones. Here in the United States, actress Carrie Fisher, who became an international pop culture icon for her portrayal of Princess Leia in the Star Wars movie franchise, has died at the age of 60. Her film debut was in 1975 Shampoo, but her legacy is the tough, feisty, and powerful Leia from three original Star Wars films between 1977 and 1983. She returned to the role in Star Wars: The Force Awakens in 2015, alongside original co-stars Harrison Ford and Mark Hamill. International Edition's Michael Lippin spoke with American film critic and historian Leonard Maltin and asked him whether Star Wars overshadowed her other cinematic appearances.
Well, I think you could say that Star Wars and the role of Princess Leia overshadowed everything Carrie Fisher did the rest of her life. You know, she's been busy as a writer, as a performer, as a participant in documentaries, as a novelist, but all people really know her for and care about is that she played Princess Leia.
Right. Do you think people should care, though, about some of the other movies that she did actually act in and that got some critical acclaim?
Well, she's in Woody Allen's Hannah and Her Sisters. She's in When Harry Met Sally. She's in some pretty memorable and prominent films. So that shouldn't be forgotten. She's in a great episode of 30 Rock with Tina Fey playing herself. And she was a talent. There's a reason George Lucas cast her. She was good.
How did Carrie Fisher get to be so good? Because she acted in the first Star Wars movie at the age of 19. So what was her path to get to that point?
Well, she grew up in show business. She grew up prominently in show business. Her mother was and is Debbie Reynolds, a big star, a versatile star who could sing, dance, act, the whole works. And her father was a very popular singer, Eddie Fisher. So she grew up in and around show business. It was in her blood.
Why do you think Carrie Fisher, later in her career, did more work behind the scenes than in front of the camera?
I think she came to feel a certain reluctance to appear on screen. She became very self-conscious about her looks. She gained some weight. She got a little older. People were unkind and commenting about that. She was aware of that. And I think that was a source of some hurt to her. But she never stopped writing. In addition to writing novels and a recent memoir, she was known as a script doctor. The directors would bring screenplays to her to add love interest, and she became one of the most reliable script doctors in town.
I actually read that she wasn't really credited on screen for some of those script doctoring roles.
No,
how unusual is that?
That's typical. It's very typical. Very, very big names sometimes contribute this way to films doing a final polish or a final draft. They get a lot of money, but no credit.
Well, you know, Carrie Fisher obviously had a very eventful personal life in terms of her relationships, her struggles with drug addiction. But what's interesting to me is that she remained fairly well-loved here in the U.S. and beyond in spite of that. Why do you think she was able to remain such a popular figure in, you know, popular culture?
Well, she made the jokes before anyone else could. She beat them to the punch, or beat them to the punchline, you could say. She did a one-woman show called Wishful Drinking about her problems with alcohol and with abuse, and about her turbulent life growing up in the spotlight, daughter of celebrities, headline-making celebrities. So, as I say, she kind of undercut anybody's ability to use her as fodder. She used her own life as fodder.
Seems like a
good
strategy.
And she wrote a memoir called Postcards from the Edge in the form of a novel, but it's pretty autobiographical, and wrote the screenplay for that. So she took full credit for herself.
Well, you know, she does have one other film that's yet to come out, that's Star Wars Episode VIII. What do we know about, you know, her role in that final movie and what this means for the future of the franchise?
Not a thing. I know, not a thing. But remember that in Rogue One, they brought an actor back to life who's been dead for 20 years. So who knows what will happen in the future.
And that is American film critic and historian Leonard Moulton speaking about the late actress and writer Carrie Fisher. He spoke with International Edition's Michael Lippin. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. The world of pop music lost another star this past weekend, George Michael. I spoke with VOA's Border Crossings host, Larry London, about Michael's long and successful career.
Christmas Day, of all days, to unfortunately lose George Michael at the age of 53, apparently from heart failure, although there is an investigation undergoing right now because there was perhaps some medication involved. George was very, very private, very, very secretive about his life. Not too many people knew a whole lot about his life. His partner, Fadi Fawaz, is the person who discovered him at home. They were supposed to go to lunch that day, and he was found unresponsive. Apparently, he suffered this heart failure the night before. When the medical team showed up at the house, it was, you know, it was already a lost cause. He was already gone. And so, yes, it is a tremendous loss. George Michael, who sold over 100 million records throughout his career, the last album he put out, the last actual studio album, was 2004, and an album called Patience, although 10 years later he did release a collection of live songs called Symphonica was the album. He was on tour that year in 2014 when he came down with pneumonia and canceled the tour. And faced death at that time. It was pretty close. In fact, they said that when he was in the hospital in Europe that they even had to perform a tracheotomy on him. And he never fully recovered. He was very, very quiet, very generous, which is things that are coming out now. All the money he donated to various charities and people in need.
I've been reading about that. He was involved with a number of organizations.
And a lot of people didn't know that. He was a like I say, a very humble man. He wasn't looking for the attention. He did things on a very quiet level. He didn't, you know, try to attract attention to himself. So it is a sad loss in what has been a very, very difficult year in the world of music. Leon Russell, Leonard Cohen, Glenn Frey, David Bowie, Prince. You know, it's just been a very, very difficult year of loss in the world of music.
Certainly has been. Thanks very much, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings. Because I gotta have faith. I gotta have faith. Because I got to go with faith. I got to go with faith. And that is George Michael singing his song, Faith. Well, Apple devices, according to a new report, were the most popular electronic gifts this holiday season. Mobile marketing research firm Flurry said 44% of all electronic items activated during the holidays were Apple devices. Arch rival Samsung was second with 21%, and Huawei was third, followed by LG and Amazon. Now, despite Samsung's second-place finish, activations were up 1%, according to Flurry. That was despite a massive recall of the company's Galaxy Note 7, which was plagued with overheating issues. Notably absent from the list is Google, which unveiled two new phones, the Pixel and the Pixel XL. Chris Klotbach, director at Flurry, and Lali Kesraju, Flurry's marketing and analyst and an analytics manager, said in a blog post that with only two devices, the Pixel and Pixel XL, and mixed market reception, Google struggled to drum up excitement during the holiday season. Flurry also found that so-called phablets, devices generally larger than a phone but smaller than a tablet, remain popular. The firm said 37% of activated devices were phablets, a 10-point jump from last year. Well, that's our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Throughout this holiday season, the United States government is profiling the cases of prisoners unjustly held around the world and the families they leave behind. The campaign is sponsored by U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, and is known as #FreeToBeHome Political Prisoner Campaign. The stories of these individuals highlight the broader struggle faced by so many families of political prisoners who have to commemorate countless family occasions with loved ones behind bars. One such individual is Ukrainian film director Oleg Sentsov, who was arrested in Crimea in 2014, shortly after Russia's occupation of the peninsula, in retaliation for his vocal opposition to the occupation. In 2015, a Russian court convicted him and a fellow activist, Alexander Kolchenko, of plotting terrorist attacks in Crimea in a trial that Amnesty International described as redolent of Stalinist-era show trials. Heather McGill, a researcher at Amnesty International, went on to say, "This trial was fatally flawed and credible allegations of torture and other ill treatment have been ignored by the court." Sentsov was given a 20-year sentence and is incarcerated in a penal colony in the Siberian region of Yakutia, about 3,500 miles from Ukraine's capital, Kiev. He has not seen his two young children or wife since. His co-defendant, Kolchenko, received a 10-year sentence. At least 10 Ukrainians are serving long jail sentences in Russia following dubious trials. Others are in captivity in separatist-run eastern Ukraine or in occupied Crimea. In a letter from Sentsov, smuggled out of prison in September, he wrote, "There are many of us held in Russia and even more in Donbas. Some have been freed, others hope and wait." Sentsov was detained for exercising his universal rights. He represents thousands of other prisoners unjustly detained around the world. The United States, said Ambassador Power, calls on all governments, including Russia, to release their political prisoners. Political prisoners should be free to believe. They should be free to be loved. They should be free to be home.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.